This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation on our website, wnpr.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We are live today from our New Haven studio at Gateway Community College. We'll be explaining why in just a moment, but I want to welcome back, as always, Colin McEnroe, who held down the fort so ably while I was away traveling across Europe during the course of the last couple of weeks. Hi there, Colin.
Good morning and welcome back, Mr. Dankosky.
I'm very glad to be here. Also with us today is Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, who's got a new book coming out very soon that I'll ask you about again. Kalila, always good to see you.
Good to see you.
And Paul Bass, who's editor of the great New Haven Independent. Paul has biked across town and is here with us, as always, whenever we're in our New Haven studios. Paul, great to see you.
Nice to see you, John. Thanks for having me on.
So we're in New Haven today because, well, it's become a center of political gravity this week. It's after a second sexual misconduct claim against Judge Brett Kavanaugh came to light, made by a former classmate at Yale. It has once again put the university in a bit of an awkward position. On Monday, more than 100 students traveled to Washington, D.C. to protest Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court. Others staged a sit-in here in New Haven, urging the Senate to vote against the 1990 Yale law grad, or at least have the FBI investigate the claims. Many Yale faculty canceled their classes so that students like Madison Needham could attend. And we may hear from Madison Needham. Perhaps we won't. Perhaps we'll get into our conversation here. Essentially, Colin, what this young Yale law student is saying is, we want to say the legal community is not united behind Brett Kavanaugh. The Yale Law School is not united behind Brett Kavanaugh. And as I suggested in the introduction, there's a little bit of a mixed message here coming out of the students and some of the faculty from Yale. They're saying, on one hand, we want a thorough and complete investigation of what happened so that we can know and we can better make up our minds. But then at the same time, a large majority of the people are you know, have hashtag Stop Kavanaugh, and they've already said, we don't want this guy in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Brett Kavanaugh is having a pretty terrible week or two. Probably in second place might be Yale, and just in the sense that there is a lot of confusion here, ranging from a press release that came out in July when Kavanaugh's nomination was announced, that it was full of accolades from, I think, five faculty members or officials. Was that an endorsement of Brett Kavanaugh? If it was an endorsement, do they have to rescind that endorsement? Should they rescind that endorsement? Meanwhile, there's just this constant spillage of tales of Yale's undergraduate drinking culture that wind up with the Deborah Ramirez story, but not just the Deborah Ramirez story. I mean, some of the facts are about Brett Kavanaugh's undergraduate years in Yale are still in dispute. But other than the fact that he claimed on Fox News that he was not a heavy drinker at Yale, I mean, nobody else seems to support that account. One of the things that seems pretty clear is that he spent a lot of his nights here at Yale drunk, and that's certainly not an image that Yale necessarily wants to maintain. And you could top that off with the fact that he belonged to two different organizations, a fraternity and a society, each with kind of a drinking and misogyny reputation. None of this is stuff that Yale really wants to, you know, have bruited about as part of this nomination process that everybody's watching.
And just because, Kalila, everybody is watching this and we're now hearing about potential heavy drinking in the 1980s by students, either who are undergrad or at the law school, this is not new news to people who follow Yale very closely, because we've seen many, many other instances of this, including misogynistic behavior by other students and fraternities much, much, much more recently than this. So these things are all getting tied up together in this big soup of a conversation and a controversy at Yale University, kind of once again that ties up privilege and drinking and sex and a whole lot of stuff that, as Colin said, isn't necessarily making for the best week for the university.
Well, I think it's about privilege, but it's also about entitlement, this idea that if I can ascend to this position, I am entitled to do whatever I want and to not necessarily be held accountable to that. For that. But I think this is not unique to Yale, and we should be very clear. This is happening on college campuses across the country, and we have to really look at that climate and that culture and the way it's not just students who become complicit in this, but we also have cases of professors behaving badly, taking advantage of people, committing sexual assault and sexual harassment, and being rewarded for that behavior. So it's not just about the 80s. It continues because we allow it to.
And I think I agree with Kalila, and I think with the real question for Yale is, what does it mean to be a perpetuator of power? because Yale Law School and Harvard have consistently now sent all the Supreme Court justices to the bench. They all Supreme Court justices either went to Harvard or Yale and are either Catholic or Jewish. You know, 6-3 Catholic Jewish, 5-4 Harvard and Yale. And at Yale Law School, what you're seeing with the students protesting is it's a very liberal place. But there's a second part of Yale Law School, which is more about perpetuating its power. So no matter whom the president nominates, Yale Law School is going to usually say they're great. And when you think about the who's sending all these right-wing judges now, it's the Federalist Society, founded by a Yale law grad, son of a Yale law dean. And when they get nominated, so even these left-wing professors, when Kavanaugh was first named, they all had to say he was great. And Akhil Amar, I think, is intellectually honest. He's a professor who, even though he's a liberal, correctly said that President Trump was going to prevail on the travel ban based on the Constitution. But they all say, when my wife went there, she said it was just a self-love place. And it's a self-love that involves saying we're the greatest, we're the smartest, even though they don't actually teach you how to prepare a will. They really teach you how to run the country and be in power.
Well, and we actually heard that from when Laurie Mack, our reporter, went and talked to some of these students who are at the sit-in, Paul. I mean, they were saying specifically these words, even though on one hand they were protesting Brett Kavanaugh and everything Brett Kavanaugh, everything Republican. On the other hand, they were acknowledging that one day we, as Yale Law School graduates, will be inheriting these seats of power. It is part of our duty to come forward and say something about this because we hold a very special place in society. And on one hand, the rest of us in society might roll our eyes, but you know the stats you talked about before, they're true. I mean, yeah. this is the reality. These are people who will hold the seats.
And this
of power.
Is the underbelly of our current power structure in the country, how it's been solidified with a self-perpetuating elite. And under the veneer of the liberal politics of Yale is a very regressive, Yale Law School's very regressive engine for just keeping unaccountable, entitled people in power.
I just want to back up what Paul said before. I had Alito handle my first real estate closing, and he made a mess of the whole thing.
Thomas got it right.
He was not prepared.
That's because Thomas interned at Legal Aid.
So I think it's sort of interesting to backtrack. I want to backtrack to two things. One of them is years and years ago, there was a man named Douglas Ginsburg who was a nominee for the Supreme Court. He was disqualified because he had smoked marijuana. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, I don't think there's a disqualifier anymore. But instead, we're having the conversation that marijuana advocates have wanted us to have for a long time, which is how much more destructive and pervasive a problem alcohol is, and how many more bad things happen as a result of alcohol. I find that part of this kind of interesting, that you know, we've talked a lot over the last week or so, and rightly so, about issues of forcible sex and sexual harassment. But the alcohol component of this, which I think has kind of come to fore a little bit more over the last 48 hours, is another interesting part of this. The other quick thing I wanted to say was, just looking back for a moment, is, you know, looking back to July, it really did seem as though the Trump administration had found their dream nominee, a guy who was unassailably very conservative in exactly the way they wanted him to be very conservative, but had this impeccable scholarly record that seemed unassailable, so that you had a guy, you know, with liberal credentials like Akhil Reed Amar say, look, He's as terrific as it's going to get among lawyers under 60 or judges under 60 in America in terms of his work, his scholarship, his judicial chops. So that's what they had in July. This is what they have now that they didn't see coming. It really has been a very quick fall.
It's a quick fall, Kalilah, and it's an interesting quick fall. There's so many different ways in which conservatives now are spinning this story. There's the way in which many conservatives are saying, look, this is just part of an ongoing Democratic witch hunt. This is an October surprise. This is what happens whenever we're trying to delay a nomination. On the other hand, there's people saying, well, look, we really should have some sort of an investigation. But what I find so interesting and pervasive, especially given what happened with Anita Hill so many years ago, is this still ongoing misunderstanding of sexual power, how it plays out, whether in the workplace or on the college campus. And we're still hearing things from some of the same Republican senators that we heard in 1992?
Well, that's partially because many of them are still in the Senate who were there in 1992 when Anita Hill was going through this. The big takeaway for me, though, is that when people say, well, how do I know how I'm supposed to interact with women? How do I know that you're not going to take this as sexual harassment, even if that is not my intent? I think we're all smart enough. If you get to the level of Yale Law School or being considered for the court, we are all smart enough to know that it means keep your hands to yourself, keep your words to yourself when you speak of things that aren't germane to the topic at hand. And when we create a culture that says this is just about boys being boys, or I've heard so many people say, well, maybe he was in high school, and who didn't do that when they were in high school? I didn't do that when I was in high school, and I know plenty of men who did not. So not only do we condone bad behavior, but we also create very low expectations for men and women in our society.
And that's a huge part of it.
Yeah, and I agree with Kalila, and I think that the biggest question here is not who's going to be the Supreme Court, but whether the government of the United States, from the president on down, is going to keep this idea that if you didn't say anything when you're raped, then you're wrong. And the most amazing moment of this whole process for me was when Donald Trump said, well, if she really was raped, she would have told someone right away. And what the reaction here in New Haven has been interesting to me, I'm sure it's everywhere else, is so many women are coming forward to talk about having been raped. On Facebook the other day, there's a prominent woman in New Haven for the first time told her story of being raped as a teenager and why she didn't tell anyone, and point by point why everything the president said was wrong. When you have the most powerful people in the land trying to get someone on the Supreme Court who has a record of disrespecting women and philosophically wants to roll back women's rights, now hinging on the idea of whether it's going to be respectable for people in power to say is what our country believes, with these long debunked ideas about what rape is and when you can believe a woman. That's a heavy moment.
Yeah, and it's so interesting, Kalila, because, I mean, the Me Too movement, as it began, it started to bubble up these conversations to the forefront of the American mind, really for the first time for a whole lot of people. But this latest series, as Paul said, this tweet storm, so many women. I will say, two women I know personally and professionally, for the first time ever, to my knowledge, came out and said that they were raped a long time ago in public and spoke very openly about it. And they talked about why they didn't come forward and why they thought they wouldn't be believed. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty powerful moment in American history, I think.
It is. And the reality is that everyone listening to this show, whether they know it or not, has someone in their life who has been a survivor of sexual assault or sexual harassment. And so what is the message that we send, not to victims, but they are survivors? What is the message we send to survivors when we spend so much time defending people that we don't know while overlooking the feelings, the pain, and the experiences of people that we do know? So whether that's a Bill Cosby, whether that's Brett Kavanaugh or R. Kelly, we have to think about what this means, that it is so pervasive that we are not only silencing survivors, we are then making them defendants for the pain they have suffered.
Can also now add Padma Lakshmi, who is a huge cooking celebrity. She's in the New York Times with a story like this. One of the stories that I heard that really I found very moving was Caitlin Flanagan's. She's a writer for The Atlantic, but she also told her story on The Daily, the podcast of the New York Times. And there's a component of it, I think, that hasn't been talked about that much, which is that for her, the boy who assaulted her, the young man who assaulted her in high school, sought her out later and came to a store where she was working. She was working in a retail environment. He came to her and just tearfully said how sorry he was, and I mean, this was a thing where he kind of jumped on her in a car at a beach, and it didn't go all the way to a full rape, but it was a very scarring experience for her. But she said in this interview that it did so much that he sought her out. That he talked about how incredibly bad he had felt about this for years. And this is a part of it that is missing for Brett Kavanaugh, and probably will have to stay missing for Brett Kavanaugh, because he doesn't acknowledge it. And we ultimately don't know for sure what happened in that room all those years ago. But the moment where Brett Kavanaugh could have said some things publicly too, even if he had said, look, I was kind of a jerk for a number of years in my youth, and I was using alcohol entirely the wrong way. And there's things that I remember that I wish I'd never done, and there are things that I don't remember that alarm me, you know, and I'm so many miles away from that today that I hope I'll be judged for the man that I am now. That's not the way he's played it. He's played it as a choir boy all the way through. And I think that's ultimately going to be a problem for him. And I think even just on a personal level for all of us, you know, it's now clear, I think, if nothing else, is that he wasn't a choir boy, you know, and having a little honesty about that would have been very healing, I think, for the entire country, no matter how this nomination plays out.
I want to loop back, actually, to the Yale connection as we do the wheelhouse here out of New Haven, out of our Gateway Community College studios today. There's a whole series of other reports that have come out in The Guardian and other publications that prominent Yale Law School professors privately remarked to female students they needed to have a quote, certain model-like quality if they wanted to clerk for Judge Kavanaugh. This is Amy Chua, Yale Law School professor and best-selling author. She's since denied some of these claims, Paul, but it gets back to what you were saying before, whether it's Akhil Rita Maher, who has certainly liberal credentials and also legal credentials, who came out in support of Brett Kavanaugh and now has said, most recently on All Things Considered on NPR last night, look, I really think there should be an investigation, whether it's other classmates of his who previously had signed on in support of him who are now asking for an investigation. But now there's this other story about a whole different layer about Kavanaugh and Yale.
Yeah, I thought I don't get too into the weeds. The Amy Chua comments about what she advised people were so hard to interpret, and she's been very ill, so you can't really, you know, she says it wasn't meant that way. It really doesn't matter whether she was telling people, hey, you better dress like this so you can work for him, or if she was saying, stay away from him, he's one of the two worst judges to clerk for if you're female. The fact remains, you had to look like, you know, he expected you to look like Victoria Sweet, the fact secrets to work there. The fact remains he had that reputation. The fact remains that as an adult, not as a kid, he was still making this supposed joke about what we do stays with us and don't tell our wives when we get drunk and act crazy. So, I mean, the guy's obviously a pig, and we're just deciding whether we're going to say that our government tells women we exist to make life harder for you if you get raped and assaulted, or you say our government's on your side.
Well, I think it also makes it clear that promoting misogyny and patriarchy isn't contingent on your genitalia. So a lot of the defenses of Brett Kavanaugh I've heard have come from women who say, well, who didn't do that in high school or who didn't have that experience in college? And some people say, well, look, if a woman says that we should be concerned about this or this is incredible, then certainly it must not be a credible case. And so we have to be very cautious about that and understand the ways in which women become complicit in promoting this and allowing it and why it's even more important for people to stand up.
Okay, so what do we see of the result of tomorrow's very unusual hearing? We haven't had very many of these in the history of American politics, and tomorrow, starting at 10 o'clock, we're going to be hearing, as Kyle said, some of the same senators sitting there, but not actually asking questions themselves, Colin, of Judge Kavanaugh's accuser, Christine Blasey Ford. There will be a female law clerk, I suppose, asking these questions in an attempt, as the senators say, to be sensitive to her.
I believe it's somebody they've hired from Arizona who's a prosecutor.
Sex crimes prosecutor.
So, yes, and one of the reasons they've had to do that is that the Republican contingent on this committee is 11 men. So there wasn't a Susan Collins or a Lisa Murkowski or anybody like that they could take point on this. That's one of the reasons. I guess I feel as though, because there really isn't anything resembling a conservative in the room, I should say that, you know, tomorrow is a lot of things, but, you know, it's also Kavanaugh's opportunity to make the case that the worst of these charges are not true. He is, and I think, you know, we should also acknowledge there's a substantial contingent of people in America. You might have heard this morning on Morning Edition some of the polling on this. There's a substantial contingent of people in America who just don't know what to think about all this, and also a substantial number of people who think that he is being destroyed for political purposes. And ideally, tomorrow is a moment where we get a lot more information about that. We get it from her, from Dr. Blasey, and also from Kavanaugh. We have an opportunity to take the measure of them. But I think it's also worth saying that in terms of fact-finding, And obviously, committees can act however they want. They're not courts or anything. But this is not a good way to do fact-finding. I mean, ultimately, what you'd want to do is subpoena everybody who had some kind of relevant testimony. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me that in Dr. Blasey's story, there is an acknowledged third person in the room, Mark Judge, and he is not being subpoenaed. Now, there are a lot of reasons why the Republicans don't want Mark Judge to be subpoenaed. But, I mean, in a story like this one, where there is an alleged third-party present eyewitness, to not have that person testify, and probably a bunch of other people as well, is kind of a hint that we're not going to do real fact-finding.
Yeah, and what do we get as far as facts tomorrow, mm-hmm. Kalila? I mean, we can't expect much more than literally a he said, she said, a few hours of questions back and forth.
And I think because of that, we have to concede two points here. First, yes, it is political. It's always political. Whether it is Merrick Garland and Sonia Sotomayor sitting in the seat, or it's Brett Kavanaugh or Clarence Thomas sitting in the seat. It is an inherently political process because there are politicians overseeing this process. The second point to concede here is that there will be no wins tomorrow. Professor Ford's life will be forever changed. So whether people hear something that they say, okay, now I believe her, or maybe at least I have doubt, or whether people say, look, this confirms why this was a witch hunt against Brett Kavanaugh. There is no win tomorrow. The real question is what happens after this hearing, whether it is for women who come forth, whether it is for men who come forth to say, we are left out of this conversation, or if it changes the way that things happen in the midterms going forward.
Do you expect it, Kalila, to look substantially different than what happened with Anita Hill all these many years ago, given the fact that when her claims came out, she sat and was questioned by these male senators, all male senators, both Republican and Democrat. And I think we should not forget that the Democrats on that panel were equally as harsh and equally as difficult to deal with for her, someone who had brought forth very credible claims of sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm wondering how you see it as different from your historical lens as a political science professor.
Well, I think that they will be much more cautious in how they ask questions or the types of questions that they ask. I know that, you know, we like to romanticize history, but I remember seeing Joe Biden ask these very embarrassing questions to Anita Hill because he wanted to be sure. I want people to know that I'm nonpartisan in my way of going at her. I think so in that way, we won't hear those kind of direct comments. But it's also about the character of the allegations are so different here that will shape it. But we also need to, again, remember, it's the same people leading the process.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about a survey that happened at the state capitol here in Hartford. It actually talks a little bit about sexual harassment and some of the things that happened at our state capitol. We'll continue this conversation as well with Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, with Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent, and with our own Colin McEnroe. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're broadcasting live from our studios at Gateway Community College in New Haven today, as New Haven has become a little bit of a center of political conversation this week around the Kavanaugh hearings. We're joined by Paul Bass. He's the editor of the New Haven Independent. Also by Kalila Brown-Dean, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. Hey, quickly, Kalila, can you remind us about this book that you've got coming out next year?
So the title is Identity Politics, Context, and Controversy. And so for all of the divisions that we see in the United States right now, there's historical precedent for that. So whether we're talking about conflicts over gender identity and sexual orientation or religion, my argument is that discrimination is as American as apple pie.
So that's coming out next year.
Fall 2019.
Excellent. Very, very good. Colin McEnroe, of course, is the host of the Colin McEnroe Show. What's on your show today, Colin?
Well, I'm going to leave the studio here in New Haven after we're done with The Wheelhouse. I'm going to go over to the Yale campus. I'm going to have a keg of beer because, I'm on the Brett Kavanaugh diet. And then I'm going to come back. I feel like I've known Joyce Maynard all my life. In fact, I've never met Joyce Maynard. But when I showed up here as a freshman at Yale, all those many moons ago. She had written this sort of groundbreaking essay about what it was like to be young and alive and a student at Yale at that particular moment. And she's gone on, of course, to have this storied literary career. She's back in town today. We were going to sit down and talk about her memoir, but I'm being told that she's very eager to talk about the current, all the things that we're talking about here today. So there'll be a lot of that, too.
That should be very, very interesting. So that's coming up at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show today. Actually, before we pivot off this, I just want to ask you quickly, Kalila, maybe get some thoughts from others in the room. There's, of course, the specter of the midterm elections hanging over this. One of the reasons why the Republican senators don't want to be seen questioning Christine Blasey Ford necessarily in the way that Anita Hill was questioned is because, well, some of them are facing re-election, but the entire Senate and House are up for grabs in some ways, and there's a thought that what happens over the course of the next couple of days is going to have some impact on that. What impact do you see it having politically in the country?
So I think statistically we need to remember that women not only make up the majority of voters in this country, we also have seen a tremendous increase in the number of women running for office this year, and women coming from different demographics. So we have the potential to elect the first two American Indian women into the U.S. Congress. And so that has activated new bases. It's increased the voter turnout engagement. So this is an opportunity for those people to be held accountable who are viewed as voting against women's interests or voting for the party instead of their constituents.
What do you see as the political fallout here, Paul?
I'm very interested in the swing Democratic voters, Joe Manchin, Heidi Heitkamp, you know, the ones who are trying to hold Trump country in Democratic seats. And the feeling was always they were going to have to vote for Brett Kavanaugh. And it's tougher for Manchin as a man in this one, but I think for the women, they might have an out now. I think Heidi Heitkamp might be able to say, as a woman, and then appeal to swing voters. You know, Clyde was talking about the independent female voters who somehow voted for Donald Trump, I guess the white ones. You know, will this give an opening Democrats to vote no, especially if Lisa Murkowski moves?
Mm. Colin?
Well, I don't underestimate the ability of Mitch McConnell and his kind to turn this into their issue. So let's imagine that Brett Kavanaugh goes down in flames one way or another. Either he pulls himself off the table or he doesn't make it through. I mean, tomorrow could be so powerful that Susan Collins and Murkowski and a bunch of other Republicans go to McConnell and say, look, we just can't do this. McConnell could.
And you can't make us do this.
And McConnell might say, you know what? Vote your consciences. I'm fine. Go ahead. Do that. Because one of the things that he can then say to the base is, look, I don't have a big enough margin in here, you know, and particularly to the religious base. The Republicans who care the most about the Supreme Court are religious Republicans. Mm-hmm. And he can say to that group of people, I mean, it's weird for me to think of waving Brett Kavanaugh as a flag to the religious right to say, boy, we really needed this guy and we couldn't get him. But they'll do it. And it may be a pretty persuasive argument in terms of ginning up turnout in certain elections. Like, I just need these seats or we're not going to be able to confirm the people we want.
But isn't it true, Colin, that any nominee that Donald Trump puts forward over the course of the next couple of years is going to, whether it's Brett Kavanaugh or not, somebody who has maybe a less stellar judicial record, maybe a more stellar record as far as people coming forward with allegations against him. But isn't it true that any of them will probably perfectly acceptable to people on the religious right? They will all be people who will try to overturn Roe versus Wade and some of the other things that they see as the important pieces of what a Supreme Court justice will do.
Right. Paul was alluding before to the Federalist Society and the role they now have in selecting, vetting, grooming these kinds of candidates. The one thing that the right doesn't want anymore is another David Souter, right? A guy who comes in with something resembling conservative credentials and just isn't that guy. So they're going to be very careful to do that. I think that if, in fact, Kavanaugh doesn't make it, expect a nominee who's a little bit more of a cipher. We certainly won't have that administrative background, the star stuff, you know, White House work, a lot of written records. There'll be judicial records, and maybe that's about it. And obviously, maybe a little bit more of a fly-specking on the character issues. But you're going to see another nominee who will have all of the same belief system, but probably a little cleaner in terms of written background and stuff like that.
In support of Colin's point of how the Republicans can use this in the midterms, this is one issue on which the two oddly shotgun marriage aspects of the Republican electorate can be fused. The never Trumpers, the people who are true conservatives who are aghast at Donald Trump, they love him for the Supreme Court. They're getting everything they want. And the religious right, despite his personal behavior, Trump, they're getting everything they want. So I do believe that the people who are otherwise never Trumps, the Ben Sasse, those kind of people, the Weekly Standard, they will rally around the idea of how important it is in their view for Republicans to keep the Senate if Kavanaugh goes down.
Yeah, keeping the Senate, Kalila, is the most important thing for Republicans no matter what.
And it's, you know, every politician, every voter is driven by self-interest, however we can figure that self-interest here. So I don't see masses of conservatives saying we are willing to concede this for some greater good. This is all about trying to protect your power. With all of the uncertainty with the White House, I think many conservative voters know we need to make the most of this moment because we don't know what's going to happen in the White House 2 months from now or even 2 days from now.
I want to turn to a story that hits a little bit more locally home here. It's still, though, about sexual harassment. A new survey about how prevalent it is here at Connecticut State Capitol. The survey found that harassment is perpetuated by state legislators themselves. 593 lawmakers, staff members, lobbyists, and others working at the Capitol participated in an anonymous survey. At least 86 of them reported being sexually harassed by a member of the General Assembly. And there's a bit more in these findings, Colin. I guess I'll just ask you, how exactly did these findings in this report, as reported by Christine Stewart at CT News Junkie, how did they strike you?
Well, they didn't come as a huge surprise. And I don't know, I started covering the legislature, I think, in 1979, and I can guarantee you things were even worse then. But one thing about the legislature is this. If you were to walk around any area, any public area in Connecticut, and ask people who their state who's your state rep and who's your state senator, most people don't know. Most people simply, even reasonably well-informed people, are not sure who their legislators are. But at the state capitol, it's like Olympus, or it's like Disneyland and they're Mickey or something, you know. At the state capitol, they're like really, really important. And so it's also not surprising to me that in this study, it seemed as though an awful lot of the sexual harassment was coming from legislators because they have this demigod-like status in this one tiny little patch of real estate in Connecticut. In the rest of Connecticut, they're just schlubs who nobody knows their names or anything like that.
And that's the essence of power and status, so that you can have people who would be outsiders in any other domain, but in this particular place, they have access, they have power. And it also shouldn't be surprising when you think about 5 years ago, you had Ernest Hewitt make that comment about having a snake under his desk. And then there were all of these people who said, well, that's why we don't send female interns to him, or that's why he said he doesn't want women working in his office. And the biggest punishment was to strip him of a title, as opposed to calling for his immediate removal from the legislature. So it's about culture. It's also about the ability of people to stand up and feel like they will be protected and not punished for saying no.
I found interesting in Christine Stewart's article that the respondents said the reason they don't tell anyone is they feel there really is no recourse. There's a bill, you know, that all the leadership, both parties, put through to try to protect people who are victims of sexual harassment at the Capitol. But women clearly say that if I get bothered by or sexually harassed by a male legislator, I'm not going to have recourse. They're not going to take it seriously, so I'm not going to report it.
Does any of this, you think, ever trickle down to the state capitol? Paul, as Colin says, it's been run the same way for such a long time. As we have this big national conversation, Me Too, as it goes across America, and then these hearings with Kavanaugh, we begin to talk more and more about what sexual harassment means in the workplace, hopefully trying to get more women into positions of power, whether politically or in boardrooms, maybe at state capitals as well. Does this start to trickle down to the level of the Connecticut state capitol at some point?
I'm not sure. There is a candidate for lieutenant governor, major party, who voted against yes means yes and no means no on college campuses. So maybe we're having the same kind of put the question out front in Connecticut, that the same kind of discussion we're having nationally.
I'll say one thing that has changed over the years is there are more women legislators and more women legislators in roles of power. So one of the things that started to happen, the first thing that happened when that happened, was that male legislators started harassing female legislators instead of the staff. There have also been women there who've been able to stand up for themselves and put a stop to it. I mean, you've had majority leaders and speakers who are women. You would think, anyway, ultimately that's going to make a a difference. But the other part of this is, you know, there's a bigger problem with the General Assembly, which is they kind of don't have very many rules about themselves. You know, I mean, they do stuff that I think any reasonable person would regard as a conflict of interest, but they don't have to do any, they don't have to declare, they don't have to recuse, they don't have to do anything. So in an atmosphere where they, you know, are the lords and very few rules are made to govern them, it's not too surprising that they're still doing this. I would expect some progress on this because they're not exempt from the cultural conversation we're having right now, but they might be, you know, a last little enclave.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the fight for the state legislature and also about how Democrats have treated Governor Dan Malloy. And Dan Malloy, as we have said often, is the least popular governor in America. But he's done some things that Democrats would probably like to run on. And I guess the question is, have they run too far away from Governor Dan Malloy? We're talking with Colin McEnroe, Kalila Brown-Dean, and Paul Bass here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Of course, you can join our conversation, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. The host of The Colin McEnroe Show is here with me in New Haven today, Colin McEnroe, Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, and also Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven Independent. You also have your own radio show, Paul. It's Dateline New Haven. When can you hear Dateline New Haven on WNHH?
Well, you can hear it any time by going to New Haven Independent, just clicking on it because it's all podcast. But we are every morning at 11 a.m.
11 a.m. Yeah. Talking about all things New Haven and beyond.
Today we're doing about low-wage work and the plight of immigrant workers and factories in Connecticut.
Great little radio station, WNHH, part of the New Haven Independent. We've spoken at great length during past shows about the governor's race, which we'll get back to in just a moment, but perhaps even a fiercer battle being waged for control of the General Assembly. Democrats held the majority outright until the last election cycle, which resulted in an 18-18 tie in the 36-member chamber. So I guess I'm wondering, Colin, about this fight for the state Senate specifically, and how exactly Republicans are positioning themselves. They would like to have the governor's seat, obviously, but control of the state legislature might be just as important.
Maybe better. I mean, I think I've said this before, but I'll say it again. I mean, if you talk to legislative leaders in moments of supreme honesty, I think either side would probably tell you, you know, wouldn't be terrible if we controlled both chambers of the legislature by a comfortable margin and the other party had the governor's office, because it's fun to kick the governor around. And once again, to go to my last point, people don't know the names of their legislators. So if things are wrong, that, you know, they're going to blame Stefanowski or Lamont, whoever the governor is. So that's not a bad outcome, but then you actually have to do it. And I would say both sides are very nervous about this. The Republicans are nervous about the impact of a blue wave engendered somewhat by dissatisfaction with Trump. But the Democrats are worried, too. They're worried about turnout. I was talking to a Democratic leader about this last night. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see sometime in between now and November, and believe me, they are making overtures any way they can, a fellow named Barack Obama show up in Bridgeport, New Haven. You know, they need some stuff like that. I mean, this, you know, every year, every time we say it's about turnout, this one's really about turnout. I mean, Stefanowski seems to be a little stronger among unaffiliated voters, but if they don't turn out because they don't think there are any meaningful solutions coming from anybody, then they're less of an issue. And Democrats obviously hold a numerical advantage over Republicans, but if the cities don't turn out, they don't have such a big numerical advantage anymore. Watch for Barack Obama. If they can get him here, they're going to get him here.
I don't know if that's going to translate. I agree that'd be a big deal. But for instance, statewide candidates in the last 10, 20 years, they have to win New Haven by 18,000 votes. When John DeStefano, who was the mayor in New Haven, ran for governor, he did not get that margin. But Murphy always did. Malloy always did. It's going to be hard when you have Ned Lamont, whose main issue is, no, I'm the person who's going to cut taxes more than that Republican will, to motivate that base. And that's going to be a real challenge. You know, John, when you brought up control of the House and Senate, I think that even if it remains tied or close, the Republicans are going to be running the show at the legislature. I think that's why you saw two of the strongest Republicans remain not running for governor, Len Fasano and Themis Clarides, and the Senate and House leaders. They know they're going to be able. They pretty much ran the state in the last budget session when it was tied. And when you, even if Ned Lamont becomes governor, which is an if, he's going to be so weak that they're going to run the show. And I think you're going to see a Republican legislature, even if it's just, even if it's not in name and number.
Well, and I think it also speaks to this failed national strategy of the Democratic Party over the last 2 years, that instead of embracing the essence of that base, you know, what that base wants. Instead, it's been, let's see how many disaffected white voters we can pick up. Let's see how many Bernie bros and never Trumpers we can court, and abandoning that core base. And so if Democrats in the state were able to say, look, we understand that Malloy is not popular, but we also know that increasing the minimum wage helped people in the cities. It helps people in the suburbs. It helps people overall. That's something we can embrace. Giving immigrant children access to higher education so that they can stay in our state and contribute to our tax base, retaining those good parts is something that would get people out to vote. And I would just say, to your point, Colin, you know, Michelle Obama is on a tour selling out arenas. Maybe she can make a stopover in between the Barclays Center.
The other, I think, failure of the Democrats, well, we're going to talk about yet another failure in just a second, but maybe this is a segue. One of the things Democrats have typically not been very good at is talking about what government actually does and what happens when you cut the size of government too much. Dan Malloy, as we're going to get into, I think, cut 12,000 jobs or something out of the government. Roland privatized a whole lot of jobs within the government. The government's been shrinking here in Connecticut. And at a certain point, let me just give a concrete example. The next time you're filling up your car, and it seems to you like, you know, your tank wasn't all the way empty, but you're buying 16 gallons and you thought your tank only, look on the pump and see if there's a seal telling you when that pump is inspected. The Department of Consumer Protection has the job of inspecting pumps, which easily can get out of whack, not because of some unscrupulous gas station owner, but because they do get out of whack, and then suddenly you're buying more gas than you're actually getting. That's an example. If they're not doing that regularly, if they're relying on consumer complaints, people thinking, hey, maybe there's something a little goofy about the pump, that winds up costing people actually a lot of money. And there's lots of examples like that, but you have to make that argument. You have to talk about it in ways that people understand.
And I guess we'll get then to the next piece of this, which is some of the things that Kalila just outlined, some of the things that are core Democratic issues are actually things that this very unpopular governor, Dan Malloy, he championed. I mean, obviously, after Sandy Hook, he took a national lead on gun control, but he has been very outspoken in favor of LGBT rights. He's been very outspoken and even gotten awards having to do with how the immigrant population of Connecticut is treated. And Ken Dixon, our friend, wrote a really interesting piece called The Case for Dan Malloy, in which, Colin, he outlines some of these Dan Malloyian ideas that he doesn't seem to be getting any credit for. And because Democrats have run so fast and far away from him, they might not be getting any sort of associated credit for either this time around.
Right. I mean, he's taken two whacks at the pension structure, the state worker pension structure. But beyond that, and I think this is a point that Paul has been aiming at even before we went on the air, there's so many things that governors have to do. They're not simply in charge of fiscal policy. I mean, if you make this an election about fiscal policy, then and nobody ever talks about anything else, I guess that's what's that's going to be a deciding point. But yeah, I mean, I think Malloy's reforms in criminal justice have been important. The essential decriminalization of marijuana, the implementation of medical marijuana. He does have a train that goes back and forth between the city and Hartford now, which is something we didn't have before, commuter rail. There's a long list of stuff that is not just tax policy. And this election is such a one-note symphony.
And it's also problematic for state legislators to tacitly endorse this "we are anti-Malloy," because the question I would ask as a voter is, well, what have you been doing during this administration? If there are really no wins, and that's sort of the framing here, then what have you been doing? And if you haven't been doing anything, why should we continue to support you? So it's not just about turnout, which I think is so important, but it's also about this is bigger than Dan Malloy. And if you concede everything to being anti-Malloy, you give voters nothing to vote for across the board.
And it's separate from Malloy's name. I think they should look at, as you said, we've done right. Even if you're talking about fiscal policy, don't lie. Ned Lamont does not believe that tolls should just be for truckers from out of state. Ned Lamont does not believe you're going to solve a $5 billion deficit by lowering taxes and cutting the different taxes. How about telling the truth? And, you know, in terms of criminal justice reform, you talk about getting rid of the death penalty and cutting the number of people in prisons dramatically and closing prisons. Embrace those ideas, because I think one thing we learned from the 2016 election on the left and the right is people respond to genuinity. So there are over 900,000 independent voters, largest unaffiliated voters, largest bloc in the state. I think they're not left or right. I think they know when people are BSing them. So, you know, Bob Stefanowski believes some stuff that we think is kind of crazy about taxes, but he believes it. And if you listen to him, he believes that he is going to cut your taxes. Ned Lamont, deep down, clearly does not believe that you're going to solve a big budget deficit by cutting taxes.
Well, what's interesting, and you mentioned this before, Paul, if they're both going to run to, are we going to cut property taxes on the Ned Lamont side? Are we going to cut our income taxes on the Bob Stefanowski side? I saw an analysis, though, of this, which I guess I'd never really heard before, but it kind of resonated with me. Bob Stefanowski, the latest in a long line of Republican politicians who say, I'm a businessman, I'm going to run government like a business. And this commenter said, you know, if I was a business person, I probably wouldn't take my biggest source of revenue, which is about $10 billion or whatever, which is the income tax, and just say, I'm going to get rid of that. Mm-hmm. Any businessman probably would look at that and say, actually, I probably need to keep that. That's how I make my money.
And the problem is that Democrats are now running like the Republicans as a self-funding multimillionaire who doesn't really like the estate tax as their candidate. And you've now lost all sorts of good issues you can use against the Republicans.
And again, the point I always go back to, I feel like when I'm on this show, it is the problem of money and politics. Not only do you have two multimillionaires setting the stage and the policy for people across the state and really across the country, but it also is a barrier for people to get into the process to have different voices and different interests run and actually make a difference.
I do think that some of this ship has sailed. Maybe all of it has sailed. A workable strategy would have been back in January for the Democrats to say, look, you know, we can't go into this election with an incumbent governor who's got an approval rating that's like south of smallpox right now. You know, we just can't do it. We have to have a coordinated public relations campaign where we really do talk, where we basically do what Ken Dixon finally did for them, you know, where we talk about the things that have been done by Dan Malloy. We just can't run. A departing governor, but a governor whose name will be part of the electoral process. We can't do that. We've got to do something to improve his image. The problem is most of them don't like him. Most of the cabinet doesn't like him. Most of the constitutional officers don't like him. And most of the legislature doesn't like him. He hasn't been good at getting along with them. That's one of his big drawbacks. But they couldn't see past that to say, you know what? We can't head into this cycle with him with his approval rating that low. We've got to get people to understand how much he really did accomplish.
It's so funny, though, Colin, because as much as we try to talk about policy and what people actually do in office, it is very clear that Dan Malloy, being as unlikable as he can be to all sorts of different sorts of people, and he has said this on our air before, I know that I'm unlikable. Run that up against Jody Rell, who probably Ken Dixon couldn't have written that same article about all the things that Jody Rell did. But when she left office, people really, really liked her. At a certain point, Colin, it is just really about whether or not you're dealing with another lawmaker, whether or not you're dealing with a business that might leave the state, or whether or not you're dealing with a voter one-on-one. How much you are likable is really a huge part of the whole thing.
I'm reminded of a David Letterman top 10 list in 1988. It was top 10 Dukakis excuses. And one of them was, it's all just a big popularity contest. But you're right. It is a big popularity contest. And there are ways in which that has been a fatal flaw for Dan Malloy, so much so that he didn't have allies in his own party. But the people who are going to pay the big price for that, it's not Dan Malloy. He's going to go off and join a law firm or something. The people who are going to pay the big price are the people who have to run on his record that they've trashed.
And that's the point. You don't have to like Dan Malloy, but you have to love the people that you want to represent or that you claim to represent. And if you're more interested in tarnishing his legacy, he's done that on his own for people who are critics. It has to be about the voters that you claim to represent, and I don't see that happening.
I do think Ned Lamont is doing one thing strategically right, which is to say Donald Trump's name every day. And every day come out. He learned from 2006 when he won a primary and then went on vacation while his opponent defined him from day one. I think people do dislike Donald Trump in the state. I do think he is the most important figure being discussed on any level. You're talking about dog catcher politics, zoning, or the world and geopolitics. Donald Trump is what everyone talks about. So I think that Lamont's only hope in winning is to have everyone just think about Donald Trump and nothing.
But make it specific. Make it about LGBTQ issues so you get those voters motivated. Make it about climate change policy so you get those voters motivated. Don't just say Trump, but say...
And tax policy that favors the rich, which he's not the right messenger.
Don't just say Trump. Say, these are the Trump policies. These are my policies. Whose do you prefer?
Well, and also maybe, Kalilah, quickly, even after tomorrow and potentially a vote on Friday, you know, talk about Brett Kavanaugh. I mean, getting female voters engaged in urban areas, in suburban areas, certainly across the state, is going to be very important for Ned Lamont and all the Democrats at the state legislature who want to keep their jobs.
And make it clear why we all need to care about abuses of power and the protection of privilege. And to have someone of tremendous privilege be able to come forth and say, I know this world because I'm a part of this world, and that's why I'm the person to help disrupt it.
Kalila Brown-Dean is an associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. Always good to see you, Kalila. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Paul Bass, the editor of the New Haven Independent. Thank you, Paul, for coming over.
Thanks for having me, John.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. As always, Colin, thank you so much.
The minute this show is over, we're going to make you do Ned Lamont saying Brett Kavanaugh.
We're doing no impersonations. I will say, however, that The Wheelhouse is produced by Scott Brady. Our executive producer is Katie Tlarski. Today, our technical producer is Jonathan Pants McNichol. You can continue our conversation on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. I will also remind you that starting tomorrow at 10 o'clock on WNPR, we will have live anchored coverage from NPR of the Kavanaugh hearings. This is The Wheelhouse. Thanks so much for joining us.